Welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Max Kaiser. We have a great show for you today. With us we have Jan Schwartz, Associate Professor of Yiddish Studies at Lund University in Sweden. He's here to talk about his new book, Survivors and Exiles, Yiddish Culture After the Holocaust, published in 2015 by Wayne State University Press. Jan, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
It's great to have you here. First off, could you tell us, how did you come to write this book?
I'm a scholar of modern Yiddish literature, and my first book that came out in 2005 was about Yiddish life writing or autobiography. I've always been very interested in genres that are kind of a mix, hybrid forms of fiction and nonfiction, historical writing and poetry. I wanted to kind of expand the whole idea of what is literature and what is Yiddish literature. I always had this sense that what we're actually studying is a very, very tiny portion of this vast sea of works and texts out there. And so what I did was I started to look at books published, Yiddish books published after the Holocaust. And I came across a lot of authors and that I've never heard of in my training, graduate school training. And it was very exhilarating to kind of discover this richness of authors and works, and not only in the major centers, but also in minor centers. And that's really how it started. And that was one aspect of it, how it grew out of my first book. But the other thing was that I was very interested in exploring what happened to Yiddish culture and literature after the Holocaust, where there are some paradigms of the Yiddish disappeared, Yiddish died. My sense was that didn't really add up when you looked at this enormous material that I came across. And so that was the other impetus for this project, to map out Yiddish culture, particularly literary works and memoirs after the Holocaust. And so that's how the project started, basically.
So you focus on the lives and works of seven major Yiddish writers as a way of telling the larger story of Yiddish literature and culture after the Holocaust. The first writer you look at is Avraham Sutzkever, who is from Vilna. Can you tell us a little bit about his life and his works?
Yeah, Avraham Sutzkever is probably one of the truly great poets of the 20th century in any language. The thing is, though, that because he was a poet primarily, he's not that well known outside the Yiddish world, although that has been increasing attempts to make him available in translation in recent years. Sutzkever was very much a product of Vilna, Jerusalem of Lithuania. And he was part of a modernist Yiddish trend in Vilna of young writers called Jung Vilna. And they wanted to modernize and reinvigorate Yiddish poetry. Particularly, he started out in the interwar period. Other writers in that group are Chaim Grate, that is probably known he was a very well-known prose writer later on after the Holocaust, and Lasa Wolf, which was also a very interesting poet in Vilna. There were others. And this was the environment that Sutzkever started out in Vilna in the 30s, particularly late 20s and 30s. And the defining event of his life, at the defining period of his life, was, of course, the Holocaust. He was in the Vilna ghetto, and that experience really suffuses most of his poetry after the war. He wrote a great deal of what we today call Holocaust poetry, about his experiences in the Vilna ghetto. And some of these poems were actually written in the ghetto. And in my book, I'm trying to show how this new poetry that he created in a response to this catastrophe really became the paradigm of post-war Holocaust literature. He was one of the main figures of that period, and he survived, of course, and came to Palestine in 1947, and a year later he actually established a journal, one of the long-lasting and probably one of the most high-quality Yiddish journals after the Holocaust, the Goldene Kate, which was named after a play by Peretz, the great Yiddish writer of the early 20th century. And in this journal, the Goldene Kate, he basically gathered all the great Yiddish writers, that some of them had survived the Holocaust. Some of them had already escaped Europe in the 20s and 30s, and even prior to that. And there was a whole cadre of writers that I characterize as a transnational literature that basically published in the Golden Age during this period, starting in the late 40s, until it was terminated in 1996. And Sutskever was, in addition to being a great poet and a very prolific poet, who published many books of poetry and also some very fine books of prose, in a surrealistic kind of prose that he started to write in the 70s, mostly about his experiences in the Vilna ghetto and during the Holocaust. There's a volume called Die Nevuah von Schwarz Ablen, The Prophecy of the Pupils. He was a very versatile writer who worked in many different genres. And in addition to his work as a creative writer, he was also a very important cultural figure who edited this journal for a long time, for 45, 6 years. He's definitely one of the pillars of Yiddish culture after the Holocaust.
That's great. So in the next chapter, you focus in on Chava Rosenfarb. Tell us about the significance and the context of her writings.
She started writing seriously in the Lodz ghetto, although she had also written pieces before, but in the Lodz ghetto, that was really where she started out. And what's characteristic of these seven major writers that I focus on in my book is that they all kind of came into their own artistically, creatively during the war, in either in the ghettos or also in hiding in various places in Poland and in Eastern Europe. And Chava Rosenfarb was a poet. She started out as a poet and continued to write poetry, but her real claim to fame in Yiddish literature is a series of prose works, novels, and memoirs mostly about the history of Lodz Jewry, and including also the a very important work in three volumes, Das Bäum von Leben, which was published in the 70s, which is a trilogy about the Lodz ghetto. And it's a quasi autobiographical work. The main characters really model on Chava Rosenfarb herself. It's a very detailed, very panoramic work about the Lodz ghetto, basically, has been translated into English, and I think also onto a couple of other languages as well.
So in chapter 3, you look at Leib Brochmann, who is most famous for his wartime diary of survival, which was published as And in Your Blood Shall You Live, and was eventually translated into English as The Pit and the Trap. Can you tell us a bit about this work's very interesting publication history?
Yeah, what's characteristic for a lot of what we today call Holocaust writers, or that wrote writers who wrote about their experiences during World War II, either in the ghettos or in the concentration camps or in hiding or in other environments. What's characteristic of these texts are they were composed during very extreme circumstances. In the case of Leib Brochmann, he actually wrote a diary while he was in hiding with a Polish peasant outside his hometown of Minsk Mazowiecki, which is around 30, 40 kilometers from Warsaw. And he actually was in hiding with his wife. He had married just 6 months earlier in the ghetto, they actually succeeded in escaping the deportations of the Jews from the ghetto to the extermination camp, and managed to hide with a Polish peasant outside their hometown. And he kept a diary. There were five people in hiding, and including his wife and I think a brother-in-law, and then there was one or two other people as well. And they were in hiding there for over 18 months and were totally dependent on the Polish peasant for of course to give them food and shelter and protect them. And what he is basically doing in this work, which is really an unusual work, even in the context of Holocaust literature, is that he writes a diary in hiding, this diary he uses as a text that he later on, after liberation, starts to revise shape as a literary text. So on one hand, it's a very authentic historical document about the circumstances of being in hiding during this period. At the same time, it's also obviously very much shaped in an artistic way, where he creates suspense. He has flashbacks. He structures the text in certain ways that it reads often like a novel, actually. So this book came out in Paris, and it was actually published by the hometown organization of Minsk Mazowiecki, the so-called Landsmannschaft in Paris. They subsidized the publication of this book with there was an afterword to the actual diary, which was a history of the town, and it was kind of like a memorial section of the book. So the book as a whole can be considered an example of a memorial book, a Jiska book, which became a very important genre of commemoration in the Jewish world. Many of these books came out in the 40s through the 80s and 90s, mostly written in Yiddish and also to a certain extent in Hebrew, and very rarely in other languages, although there are examples of English and German sections of these books, but it's very limited, mostly predominantly in Yiddish and less so in Hebrew. That was, and these books were published by groups of survivors and people who came from the same town in Eastern Europe. And this was an attempt to create a memorial to a particular Jewish community that had been annihilated during World War II. And so these books are a mix of all kinds of genres, cultural history, list of prominent people, a history of the town, the Jewish settlement in the town, and very importantly, most of these books has a final section about the way the town were occupied and later on destroyed by the Germans and their collaborators. So Leib Rochmann's work is definitely perceived as part of that genre, although it also stands on its own as a very important literary work, a very fine literary work about a group of people under very extreme circumstances during World War II.
So tell us a bit about the extensive Yiddish book series that was published in Buenos Aires between 1946 and 1966. How was it that Buenos Aires became such a major Yiddish cultural center? And what was the content of these 175 volumes in this series?
Yeah. Buenos Aires was home to a diverse community of Eastern European Jews that came already in the 20s and 30s to Argentina and even earlier on. But prior to World War II, particularly the Yiddish cultural activities were very local in character in Buenos Aires. What changed after World War II was that there was an influx of a couple of key people, survivors from Warsaw, particularly Mark Turkov, who had been a journalist in the Warsaw and came to Buenos Aires and had the idea to create this book series that as a memorial to the Polish Jewish community. And the other thing that enabled him to do that in Buenos Aires was, of course, it was a relatively affluent community and also a very homogeneous, cohesive community. They had resources for this kind of publication endeavor. It was a large endeavor. They, at the height of this book series, they published between 3 and 5 books per year, and these were hardcover books with index and often illustrations. So it was financially a demanding and a project that required resources. And there were resources, and more importantly, there was a will and a determination in in the community in Buenos Aires to implement such a grandiose project. Although it was not easy when which I also cite in the chapter from the correspondence of Mark Turkov, it was not an easy thing to pull off such a large project of books that basically addressed all aspects of Polish Jewish life in all genres, folklore, Hasidism, socialism, memoirs and novels and poetry, all kinds of things. It was, in the literal sense of the word, a library of books about Polish Jewry from the past through the Holocaust, and it became popular. It was sold widely, not only in Argentina, but it was also shipped overseas. And we can see that it was actually distributed in Poland after the war in the 40s and 50s and in some of the DP camps. And some of the books, the profit, which was probably not that big, but there was certain profit from the sale of the books, went to relief work in the, for example, in the DP camps, and that's noted in some of the introduction to the books. So this book series is a real important part of this culture of commemoration that was created in Yiddish after the Holocaust.
That's great. So in the next chapter, you take a snapshot of the years 1953 to 1954. What sort of debates were happening within the world of Yiddish culture and politics in this year?
On the one hand, you had the development of assimilation, a linguistic assimilation. The younger generation turned away from Yiddish, particularly in the United States, and this chapter focuses very much on New York, and Yiddish became increasingly a relic of the past. So, but at the same time, this is also an expression of a new mode of Yiddish culture, which is Yiddish culture in translation and being made available not only in translation but also in the form of anthologies, in the form of influence on American-born Jewish writers in English. So this is a year where you see all these different streams of influences that really kind of converge in many ways. And then at the same time, this year also demonstrates the transnational character of this culture, where you had, of course, the main center was in terms of quantity and output of books and cultural activity was, of course, New York. But there was a lot of interaction with minor centers in, as I mentioned, Buenos Aires, in Montreal, in Warsaw, where there was now it was behind the Iron Curtain. There is this kind of still a sense of a transnational cultural system that is intact and is continuing, although being very much under pressure from by the factors I already mentioned, from because of linguistic assimilation into other languages and so on and so forth. So in this chapter, there's also a part of the chapter that really focuses on Sutzkever's activities in Tel Aviv with the Golden Gate and his attempt to There's a lot of traveling back and forth in this period, where Yiddish writers they visit various communities and lectures poetry readings. And this is exactly what Suskeva did. Fortunately, we have a very nice and comprehensive record of a lot of these lectures and readings, because many of these recordings have been made available online at the National Yiddish Book Center, particularly from Montreal. It was a very important hub for Yiddish writers in this period. At the Jewish Public Library in Montreal, you had all the major writers coming there, presenting their new work. There were discussions, there were panels, there were seminars, and so on and so forth. So this is where Yiddish culture sustained itself and continued its transnational scope after World War II. In these centers that you know, Buenos Aires, New York, Tel Aviv, Montreal, Paris, for a period in the 40s and 50s, and including Warsaw, and also after the thaw with Khrushchev, there's also a certain minor revival of Yiddish activity in the Soviet Union. And the creation of Sovietish Heimleim, a very important Yiddish journal, in the 61.
Tell us a little bit about the work of Aaron Zeitlin and Yankev Glutstein and what you call the poetics of retrieval and loss.
Yankev Glutstein came from Lublin and arrived in New York as a teenager right prior to World War I. And became one of the major exponents of Yiddish poetic modernism. He was the founder of the modernist group Insichisten, the introspectivists, in New York in 1921, and wrote some very experimental and avant-garde modernist poetry in the 20s and 30s, where he really basically created in Yiddish a similar poetic idiom that T.S. Eliot had created and Ezra Pound. And he was very much influenced by these two Anglo modernists at the same time here. Aaron Seidlin came from a very different background. He came from his father was one of the leading neo-Hasidic figures of Polish Jewry, Hillel Zeitlin. He came from a relatively orthodox religious background, and that really inspired a lot of his poetry. That was also in the beginning, in the 20s, also very influenced by modernism and by experimentation. What happened with these two poets is emblematic for a lot of other Yiddish writers after the Holocaust, that they had started out as modernists, as experimenting with language and genres, and really wanted to bring Yiddish into the cutting edge of aesthetic innovation and very, very familiar and inspired by similar trends in other literatures. For Glutstein, it was American, Anglo-American modernism. For Zeitlin, it was a mix of mysticism and Kabbalah, and also Polish literature, and he was well read in many languages. He was more, I would say, a central Eastern European intellectual and poet. So what happened to these writers after the Holocaust, after the destruction, of European Jewry was that they did not abandon their experimentation, but there was a clearly an added sensibility of coming to terms with the laws, of turning poetry into a vehicle for commemoration, for paying tribute to the past and paying tribute to a community that did not exist anymore in Eastern Europe. So we see that development very clearly with these two writers. And this is what I call, they kind of retrieved a lot of the past achievements of their communities, while at the same time also bemoaning, commemorating the loss, and in the same kind of sensibility as we see with the Jiska books, the memorial books that I mentioned early on, and that's the chapter. In that chapter, I really try to describe this poetic turn in their work from a very radical modernism and experimentation to a much more kind of subdued elegy of these communities that only existed in the poetic memory now, and that is very characteristic for this whole generation of what I call the 1945 generation of Yiddish writers.
Tell us about the Yiddish poetry series at the 92nd Street Y in New York.
What happened in the 60s was that because of a coincidence of various individuals, particularly one individual who worked at the 92nd Street Y, he organized together with Gladstein, Yankov Gladstein, the poet, a series of poetry readings at the Y that happened from 63 to 69, and often some years four or five, other years less. And here, these poetry readings features all the remaining Yiddish writers, mostly poets, that were still alive at the time. Many of them lived in New York City and were virtually unknown to the larger American literary community. And this was an opportunity for them to really break into a broader context of literary transmission. What happened was that they actually did not really succeed in breaking through, except for a couple of writers that were well-known also outside the Yiddish cultural circuit, and that is, of course, Isaac Bashevis Singer. He participated in this book, in this series of readings at the Y, and in his first presentation in 63, he read in Yiddish from his work, but in other presentations later on, and he became a very popular presenter at the Y, he only read in English. So he, in a way, succeeded in breaking out of the Yiddish cultural world and reach a younger generation of mostly of Jewish Americans that had very little knowledge of Yiddish, probably. Some of them more, some of them less. But I would say most of the other poets that read at the 92nd Street Y did not have the same kind of exposure. And it was really they read for their own constituency of the same generation of mostly Yiddish speakers, some of them survivors. So it's a very interesting document, and we are lucky that there's an audio recordings of most of these readings that I was fortunate enough to get access to, and I used in my research, and that I quote in this chapter. I would like to see this these audio recordings that are housed in the 92nd Street Y being made available online on a, today, but it's not been possible so far. But I hope it will happen, because it's a very rich material, extremely good sound quality, and you hear all the great Yiddish writers presenting their work, often with introductions by Yiddish literary critics, and you, most importantly, you can hear the atmosphere, the applause, the excitement in the room, and so it gives you a sense of this culture of Yiddish in the 60s, where it's really the last minute before it is not there. It will disappear. 10 years later, it's almost non-existent.
Well, that's great, Jan. We're just about out of time. So thanks very much for talking to us about your book today. Just before we let you go, can you tell us a bit about what you're working on next?
Yeah, I'm working right now on a project on Isaac Bashevis Singer, which will consist of a monograph, and also I'm working on anthology of Isaac Bashevis Singer's early writing from his Warsaw period that has never been made available in English translation. What's exciting about this project is that there's a very well-organized and huge archive of Singer manuscripts and letters at the University of Texas, Austin, at this Harry Ransom Center. And I'm using that archive as the basis for my research. I will be, probably next year, I will spend several months in Austin and also at YIVO working on this on this project that will, as we say in Yiddish, hopefully, Yitzhak Hashem, will result in a monograph about Bashevis Singer, his work, particularly from the Yiddish work, but also looking at translation and world literature theory. And as well, I will compile this anthology of Singer's early writing.
Well, that sounds great. So we certainly hope that you'll join us again on New Books in Jewish Studies to talk about those works. So thanks very much again, Jan. You've been listening to New Books in Jewish Studies with your host, Max Kaiser. We've had Jan Schwartz, the Associate Professor of Yiddish Studies at Lund University in Sweden. And he talked to us about his new book, Survivors and Exiles, Yiddish Culture After the Holocaust, published in 2015 by Wayne State University Press. Thanks very much.